Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Barbara from the How It Works speaker group in Columbus, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic. I never quite get that right, so thank you. My home group is also like your meeting. It's in Columbus, New Jersey. We meet on Friday nights at 8:30, and it's a great meeting. We have some great speakers, and I'm sure some of you guys have been there as well. My sobriety date is January 14th of 1997. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people, and it's funny. This is an odd program. You all know that. There's magic here. And I have to tell you that, like life, if you're new, sobriety sometimes waxes and wanes. You know, sometimes you are walking hand in hand with that power and you can really, you're clicking, you know. And other times, life is tough. And no matter how good you're really doing, it doesn't feel that well. So you guys have caught me at a low point. And I thank you for that. You can set your expectations low accordingly. But I am at one of those points where life has been tough. And yet some people that I'm close to know that, you know, that have really struggled with this. But at the end of the day, you know, we're all here and we're all together and we all hold each other up. And I'll talk a little bit about that. So whatever you have, bring it here, you know, because when you add it to what we have, you've really got some power, you've really got some grace. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit tonight. Most of you I know quite a bit about the Big Book and about our program, and it's great to be amongst that. But we've all come from a place. You know, we got here in a certain way, and I'm no different. The reason I'm here is because of the hope this program gave me, and I hope I can relay a little bit of that to you today. There is no question that there is tremendous power in this program. There is tremendous power in this room. And when I say there is nothing that we can't face, that we can't walk through with that deep down within we learn about, I've experienced it. I know many of us have experienced it. And so we have the highest of highs, something we're used to when we're out there. And sometimes we have some low points, but they're never the lowest of lows again, you know, no matter what they are, and it's a real blessing. So if you're new you're struggling, stay with us. You can get through anything here. And I do have a life beyond my wildest dreams. I used to hate when people said that. It annoyed me. You know, it didn't seem real. But if I tell you where I came from, and I'm going to, you'll see that there's a little bit of truth in that, too. You know, when I came to you, I wasn't a kid. You know, I was probably 35 years old. I had been out there a while. I had been beat up a little bit. That's putting it mildly. I was in rough shape. I had not gone to a rehab, and I didn't go to a rehab because so many people in my family had gone to rehabs, and I didn't want to be labeled as somebody that went to a rehab because I didn't want anybody watching the way I drank once I left you. See, I came here for the quick fix, you know. Even though I knew I was an alcoholic, I came here just to get the heat off, you know, like many of us do. When we're new, we seem to think that everybody comes here willingly, right? You know, like there's me and there's them. Same way we see the world, right? There's the world and then there's my world. You know, we learn that's alcoholism too. But when I came here, I was pretty fractured. I'm 35 years old. I'm educated because everybody's got something in their life that allows them to continue to drink and use other substances, right? For some of us, it's a spouse or it's parents. It might be a social program. For me, it was school. If I stayed in school, I could basically drink the way I wanted to drink until I couldn't do the school thing anymore and I had to get a job. So I have a job. I've got some paper behind me, but now I have to show up to life. I'm 35. I've never been married because that's an adult activity. I've never had any children because that's an adult activity. you know. I've never had a dog. And the only thing I really wanted, I don't know if I wanted children or a husband, but I knew I desperately wanted dogs. And I never had one. It was the only responsible thing I ever did in sobriety because I knew I couldn't take care of a dog, you know. I knew it. I knew I couldn't be home at a certain time to walk a dog. I had two cats. They barely made it, but they made it. And that's how I came here. I was living in a house that was owned by my parents. I was the only person that wasn't paying rent. I went to work dressed like I'm dressed today. You know, I almost looked like I had it somewhat together. But see, I didn't pay my bills. If I went away for more than a couple of days, my car would be repossessed because I couldn't sit down and write the check. I was furious if somebody came to my house. Most people didn't. You didn't dare knock on the door, you know. I was completely isolated. And, of course, I was in a relationship with somebody because we're always in a relationship with somebody, you know. And this last guy, before I came in here, instead of just leaving, he actually moved to England. He put an ocean in between us. You know, he was going to make sure this deal was done. And because I'm an alcoholic, and some of you might understand this, even after he went to England, I still thought we were in a relationship. If you got that, you're in the right place. Everybody else knew, obviously, that we weren't. So I come into the program, and I'm a mess. I'm physically very ill, and I came in through work, and it was a meeting that was not like this. It was not solution-based, but it was still a good group of people. It was mostly men. In fact, it was all men except me. They were older men. They were gentlemen. They were successful. They coddled me. I was there for at least 3 years and really never worked a step. But I did do one thing. I spoke to another alcoholic every single day. He was my sponsor, Nick, and God bless him. I don't know how he did that. I don't know how he listened to that for 3 years. Honest to God, I don't. But what ended up happening was he gave me a little bit of an education. He did teach me about step one. And not just the unmanageability I came in with. You know, I understood that. My life was entirely unmanageable. I got that. You know, I couldn't get in the car to go somewhere without having a beer with me, at least one, if not three, because God forbid, you know, I could get stuck in traffic. You know, I know I'm just going across town, but it could happen. Feasibly, it could happen, and what would I do? That's how I was. So I would go to work. And I would avoid the phone calls, and I would wait for the shoe to drop, you know, because we always feel that impending doom when we're out there. We know it's coming. And I'd leave at 11 o'clock to go to the bar, and I'd start drinking. And this is how I drank. I would go to the bar, and I'd tell myself, you know what, I'm going to have one or two. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to deal with all those issues I haven't dealt with, you know. I'm going to return the calls. I'm going to do the work. But I also knew that if I had one or two, I wouldn't care anymore. You know, it's a weird thing, but if you get that, you are also in the right place. We lie to ourselves and we know it. I'd have the one or two, that would turn into eight. And I had rules. And one of my rules I learned from my mother was, if you go back to work and you're drinking, they'll know you were drinking. If you don't go back to work once you leave to drink, they'll suspect you were drinking, but they'll never know it. So you never go back to work if you're drinking. So I'd go to the bar and I'd never go back to work. And before I got fired, I would quit. And I went into the program because I was sure I was about to get fired. And it wasn't regular AA because I didn't want to be seen. But I did learn something. I came in here and there was a welcoming here and there was a fellowship here. And there were a bunch of people that somehow managed not to drink. And that was unfathomable to me, absolutely unfathomable to me, if you drank the way I drank. And I learned that I did have a disease. You know, you taught me that, and they did teach me that. That I had an allergy to alcohol that made me crave it. And I understood that because I experienced that. And then they told me that I also had a mental obsession. You know, and that mental obsession was not just the white knuckling it when I came in here. It was the 6 months after I was in here and life was getting better that whispered to me. It was the 6 years into it that said, you know what, let them prescribe me Percocet because it's being prescribed. It was just that thing that was going to get me onto the dance floor, if you will. You know, and they taught me about that obsession. And they told me that if you have those two things, if you have that when I start drinking, I don't know where it's taking me, I crave alcohol, and you have an obsession, it will kill you absent a spiritual experience, you know. And I got that intellectually, but I'm still willing to take that chance, you know, because I'm an alcoholic. So Nick takes me to the second step where... I have to admit, you know, essentially that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And again, you know, I'm kind of getting it intellectually. And he told me a story, and I'll tell it to you. You've heard it. And you've all heard it. It's sort of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's sort of the short version, taking liberties. But it had to do with step two for me, and it made me understand something. And the way the story goes, the way he told it to me, was that there's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Dr. Jekyll, who lives in the 1800s in England, in London specifically. And he is meek, he is mild, he is very intelligent, he's a physician, and he's an inventor. And he invents an elixir, and he drinks that elixir, trying to get a desired result. And when he drinks it, of course, he turns into Mr. Hyde. And Mr. Hyde goes out and does all sorts of antisocial things. He robs people. He assaults people. And when he's being pursued, he goes back into the flat. The police come after him. And when they look, there sits meek and mild Dr. Jekyll. Mr. Hyde transforms back. And again, mixing up the elixir, thinking, I didn't quite get it right, let me try it again. And he mixes it up again, he drinks it again, and out he goes after being transformed, as we are, right, to Mr. Hyde. And his bad behavior escalates, and he starts murdering people, and so the story goes. And the question that Nick asked me was, who's insane? You know, is it Mr. Hyde that goes out there and murders people and kills people and, you know, dances on the table and doesn't show up for work and does the DUIs? Or is it Dr. Jekyll, the very intelligent, the very sober, the very meek and mild gentleman that you see before you? And the point of the story, of course, was that it's Dr. Jekyll. Because if Dr. Jekyll gets restored to sanity, if Dr. Jekyll stops drinking the elixir and thinking it's going to work this time, Mr. Hyde never appears. And for the first time, as simple as that story may sound, I understood that the problem was not the stuff I did when I was out there. You see, the problem wasn't the woman that wasn't paying her bills, the woman that couldn't stay out of the bar, the woman that couldn't be honest, you know, the one that couldn't even care for a dog, you know. That wasn't the problem. It was the woman that was showing up in a suit not drinking, because that's the woman that decided to go to the bar at 11 o'clock because she's powerless, you know, and I get it. The problem is me sitting here today, right now. I mean, right now, literally. That's the person that needs to be restored to sanity by a higher power. And so I'm finally getting this program a little bit. I'm understanding step two. And he takes me to step three in my program, right, where we're going to make a decision that essentially the way Nick explained it to me was, you know, you're going to decide basically that your life is none of your business, you know. You've already recognized that you don't have the power essentially to help yourself in step two. You know, there's nothing really you can do. And now you've got to turn yourself over to something else. And then he kind of hit me with it. That moment that you guys do, if you're big book people, the moment that you tell the person, either get with us or get out. And that's what happened to me. So, and I'm forever grateful. What Nick said to me was, what are you doing here? I'm like, what do you mean what I'm doing here? I've been here 3 years. Things are getting better. And he's like, yeah, admittedly, you know, you don't swear, you know, every other word out of your mouth. You know, you've learned to wear shoes. You know, when something falls off your car, you get it repaired. It's not being repossessed. But what are you really doing? I talk to you every day. You're chaotic. You're a mess. You need to do what we're doing or you need to go back to your other life. That's it. And I'm like, uh-oh. You see, because I couldn't go back there, you know. I couldn't go back there because As you all know, the misery of living in that was a little bit more than I could take. But I wasn't very happy where I was here either, you know, because I didn't really tap into that power that you guys talked about. You know, I was doing okay, good enough to start to think, maybe I got this thing. You know what we do, you know, the obsession. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. But I knew enough to know I couldn't survive. And so they invited another woman. It wasn't a tough choice who my sponsor was going to be to this program. Her name was Chris. And she was a lady. I wasn't, you know. She was tall and attractive. She did not swear. And she had a God in her life. And she had no problem telling you that. She had no problem talking about God. You know, it made me incredibly uncomfortable. You know, I'd rather talk about any other subject than that. It's like, this, you know, please, you know, too personal. But she was not like that. And she got a hold of me, and she started me on the fourth step. And what happened was nothing short of remarkable. Everything she did was painful to me. She took me out to meet other women. You know, she had networks of women. They didn't swear. You know, they weren't tough. They didn't feel like they had to show you how tough they were to make a point. I didn't know how to function in that, you know, and they talked about God, and they talked about the steps, and they went to retreats, and they supported each other. And worse than all of this, they expected the other person to show up. I was like, ooh, you know, because we don't like that. You know, we don't want ever to be expected at a meeting when we're new, you know, in my case, even when you're not so new. But they did this, you know, they didn't live the life I lived. And so I go on a retreat. I'm starting my fourth step. Now, my fourth step with Chris will take several years to complete, you know. I don't recommend it. And she takes me on a retreat to upstate New York. And I was raised in a, you know, I'm from the, you know, northern New Jersey, kind of New Yorkish area, and, you know, Irish Catholic, Catholic schools, you know, whatever. And now I go to this retreat, and who do you think the retreat master is? A Catholic nun. I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. I knew it. I knew it when I came in here, what you guys were about, and now I'm sure. So it was a Matt Talbot retreat with this Catholic nun. I'm now 40-something, and I go out into the parking lot. I take out my phone. I call my mother. I know. I said, I'm 40-something years old. I call my mother. And my mother said, you know, B, you're 40-something years old. We had this conversation, this exact conversation, but you were in grammar school. You know, what do you want me to do, come and pick you up, or you think you can tough it out for the weekend? I'm like, I'm a tough chick here. I'm like, no, I was just calling. Just call. I get it. Click, right? The truth of the matter was nothing really had happened to me except a couple pieces of paper from the time I first petitioned my mother's help at 6 and at 40-something. So I go to this retreat, and the nun is speaking, Sister Maureen, and I have all kinds of conversations going on in my head and all kinds of attitudes, and I hear something that I will never forget. It's not particularly remarkable, but it was to me. She stood in the front of the room, and she looked out at us, myself included, and she said, you know what? Every single man and woman in this room is a man and woman of dignity and honor, every single one of you. And I don't care what you've done. You know, I don't care what it looks like, your rap sheet. I don't care what your home life looks like. Because all of that stuff is about chemistry, and none of it's about character. And if you don't want to live that way anymore, then join us. Do what we did. And for the first time in my life, I really had some hope, because that kid that always had to look tough and be cool and say the right things and let you know that I didn't give a damn if you went to England or not. I don't need you. You know, that worked out well. You know, for the first time, I heard what I really wanted to hear, because all I ever really wanted to be was a decent person. You know, I really did want to be a woman of dignity and honor. I wasn't, you know. But it is what I wanted to be. And so I was willing to do what you did for the first time, you know. And I start working on my inventory. And I learn a little bit about this program and the columns. And we do it by the book, Resentment Inventory, Fear Inventory. And I was told that if I did this process, I had to know why I was doing it. You know, I had to know that this was kind of to unblock those things that were blocking me from God, you know, so that I could get to this power I needed so badly in my life that I wasn't even yet willing to call God, you know. Can't do that. I do my four step, and I do it, and what else? I pull an all-nighter, of course, right? Not recommended again. But if you are new and you're struggling with this, and I know thoroughness, I've read the book, schedule your fifth step. If you're having trouble finishing your fourth step, schedule your fifth step. You will complete it to the best of your abilities, and that's what I did. So I schedule it, I sit down with my sponsor, I go through my fourth step, and she was a sponsor who gave feedback, you know, and she said to me at the end of all of this, you know, when I had explained to her my problems, you know, that I was insensitive, that I was tough, you know, that I was critical, you know, that maybe I was a little too insightful for this world, basically, you know. And she looked at me after all of this and she said, you know, you are clearly selfish and self-centered, clearly, you know, and you are dishonest. She said, but above all else, I have never met anyone that puts so much effort into wrestling security out of other people. I'm completely floored that this woman didn't listen to anything I had said to her, right, for the last couple. The point was, obviously, you know, we can't see our own truth. So we take our fourth step into a fifth step, you know. And when I was able to sit with that for a while, I realized, you know, what she was saying was true. You know, I was really just that hurt little kid that was looking for someone to take care of her. But you better not think I needed you, you know. And when I was nice to you, it was true. I was being nice because I wanted to get something out of you. It wasn't really that I was just being nice, but I never would have seen that. I wasn't capable of seeing that. You know, I'm gonna kill you with another story. I know, I tell stories. So this is the story that Dawn told me, and if I've sponsored you, you've suffered through it. But again, it's sort of, I got the four step when she explained this to me, and it's a cowboy story. I'm fitting in with the environment here, sort of. And the story is about a cattle drive, essentially, or the imagery, really, is a cattle drive that you've all seen in John Wayne movies where you're traveling, you know, from Fort Worth, Texas to Kansas City. And in the story, I'm a cow, right? And the deal is that you're on a cattle drive, you're surrounded by all of your cows, and it's beautiful, right? You know, you're going over hill and dale and crossing streams. And it occurs to you at some point, you know, if I keep this party up and I keep running with my other cow brothers and sisters, you know, what happens when I get to Kansas City, you know? And then you stand up on your little cow feet, your little hooves, and you realize for the first time, you know, as we do in our fourth step, that, you know what, maybe I'm not making this trip on my own power, you know? Maybe I'm not making choices here in my life. You know, and the reason the little cow knows this, right, is because when he turns around and he looks, he sees 100 cowboys behind him, right? And for us, those cowboys are fear and selfishness and self-delusion and pride, you know? And the question she posed to me is, how long this cowboy's been in your life, you know? How long have you not been making choices in your life, tough girl? You know, how long have you simply been driven from here to there by your personality defects? And I have to ask myself that question now sometimes as well. You know, that's not just for the first time you go through this work. You know, when are we being driven? And you start to realize in that fourth step, you know what? Maybe all of that stuff I did, you know, I did because it was the best I could do then. And maybe that guy in my fourth step, you know, I'm starting to see him a little differently. You know, maybe I can see him the way he sees me. You know, and isn't that sort of what our fourth step's about? You know, the guy in column one, you know, the wife or the husband or the employer, what would they say about you if they were doing an inventory? You know, maybe you have a part in it. Maybe they're not well. And suddenly, you know what, we start to do something that I think is amazing. We start to see the world a little bit differently. We start to see people a little bit differently, and we start to see ourselves a little bit more lovingly through this process. And my sponsor helped me to do that in 4 and then in 5. And it is a remarkable thing, you know. And if you sit on either side of the fifth step, I think it's one of the most sacred things we do. Because if you're new and you're dreading it, you have to do it. The feeling I got when I did it was, I'm in the club. You know, seriously, I know that's immature, but after all, you know, I was 6 years old just 10 years ago. You know, I really did. You're in the club, you know, and you are, because you've done something that's incredibly foreign for an alcoholic, you know. You've done something that you didn't do because you were going to get paid for it or because you were going to, you know, disappoint mommy. You did something simply because you were told to follow a path and you trusted something greater than yourself. It's a cool deal, you know. So I do 4 and 5, and I get to what are, without a doubt, my favorite steps. Don't worry, I won't talk about them too long, 6 and 7. Because the first time I went through, I did them fairly quickly, right? I was told that, you know, step 6 was about being ready, you know, essentially being ready by doing steps 1 and 5 to have those things you identified removed so you can start being free, you know, you can start having power, you can stop being miserable in sobriety, you know. And so, all right, I'm ready. And then step 7, I was taught, was nothing more than a prayer. You know, I don't mean to get into a debate. I'll just tell you what I was told, that it has very little to do with humility, that we've become humble by doing 1 through 5. It is a humbling experience, you know, to understand that you can't help yourself, you know, to look at your part in things, to turn your life over to something you may not understand, you know. And so we make this prayer. But what really happened was something I would come back to fairly recently when life gets tough, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And that is what I learned in 6 and 7 was that a big part of this deal that we do here is service to other people. But first we have to get to God, right? First we have to get the power in our life to stay sober. And I needed everything explained to me. I do tell the stories, and they sound simplistic. And you'd be, but I needed somebody to demonstrate very clearly. And I didn't understand 6 and 7, you know. I didn't understand how to pray. I didn't understand how to get rid of defects. And I was taught. And what I was really told this deal was about was I needed to trust something other than my thinking mind, which had caused quite a bit of havoc inside and outside of the rooms, you know, before I came in and after I came in. And that, and my question was always, well, how do you do that? You know, I'll tell you how I did it. I brought my education with me, and I tried to wrestle it out of whatever higher power I had. I tried to petition it, to grab it, to have some kind of bizarre allegiance that if I did A, I was going to get B. What I didn't know how to do was what 6 and 7 teaches us to do, which is to receive what we already have. You know, 6 and 7 is really just about turning to what we learned about in step 3, that deep down in every man, woman, and child is that fundamental idea of God. You see, I had everything I needed when I walked in the door. You know, I had all of the compassion I needed. I had all of the honesty I needed. I had all of the selflessness I needed. The problem was I didn't know how to receive that. And 6 and 7 said to me, how you receive it is you sit back, you recognize that you have everything you need, you mind your own business. And so where do I do that, right? What does that look like in my life? Well, You know the answer to that by the time you get to 6 and 7, right? Because you've already done it with alcohol and maybe some other substances. The place in your life, right, and we all have it, where there's something we're not happy about and there's nothing we can do about on our own power. That is the place where we trust, right? That is the place where we go and we trust that deep down within. That's where we find our higher power. And we all experience that. If you have 10 minutes away from a drink or a drug, you've experienced it, right? And then how do you do it? How we do it is we don't focus on our problem, right? We focus on our power and our service and our program. So it's a real shift in reliance on self to reliance on God. It's a real shift towards entering the world of the Spirit that our book talks about. And that really starts to happen in 6 and 7, usually when we go back and practice 6 and 7 after we've been out there. I did my 8th and 9th step with my sponsor. I don't need to go through the mechanics of it or the examples of it. But I will tell you that, you know, no matter how you do it, I hope you do it with a lot of grace, with a lot of prayer, and with a lot of consultation with a sponsor. Because if there is an area where you will not see clearly, it is often in amends, you know. And my sponsor did have me make the little index cards with the name of the person, and I wrote one or two sentences, what I thought the harm was, and was I willing to do it or not willing to do it. And I talked to her before I made any amends, and I was to pray before I made any amends. And there were some great things that happened there, and I'm not going to bore you to death with a bunch of amends stories. But if you haven't done them, it's another opportunity to do something that we couldn't possibly do on our own without the gifts of this program. I mean, it's just, to me, it's incredible that, you know, an alcoholic, and I was a fairly low-bottom drunk, would actually go to people without trying to get anything out of them, simply to hopefully be of service someday to other people, to set things right, to take away the harm I could had done as best I could. That was not something I would have even considered, would not have considered. Now, of course, I didn't finish my amends, and this is where you don't necessarily want to get rid of all of your defects, because here's what happened. I'm in the program, like all of you, not all of you, I've taken a few hostages, you know, I've got about 9 years of sobriety at this point. I go to business in California, a business meeting. I'm no longer in the profession I was in. I got out of there before I was fired. And I'm working for my family, for their business. And I'm actually working. You know, I'm actually useful to them. That's amazing, you know. They're trusting me. And they're not doing well. They send me to San Diego because I'm meeting someone. They're going to sell the business. It's a small business, but it's all they have. It's big to my family. And I meet somebody out there. My brother introduces me. My brother's my best friend. He was in sobriety much longer than I was. He paved the way. I should have paid attention. I meet somebody, and I like him because he's from Pennsylvania. I live in North Jersey, so he's geographically desirable. He's far enough away. And because I don't do really well with relationships, shocking though that may be. I come back to New Jersey. I find out, by the way, when I'm out there, we're, of course, hosting a cocktail party. Okay. And I say, you know, would you like a drink? And he says, no. No, I don't drink. I've been in recovery for 10 years. And I think to myself, what kind of a person tells you something that personal the first time they meet you? You know, I immediately dislike him. I think he's a loser. Now, you can tell that I hadn't done my steps thoroughly, can't you? I have 9 years at this point. And I go back and I talk to my sponsor, and she says to me, you know, if you won't finish your amends, because you should finish your amends, then I can guarantee you that if you continue not to finish your amends, you're going to get the same result you always got in relationships, because you need to have a complete spiritual awakening in order to be in a relationship. You know, you don't know how to have one. So I finished those amends for all the wrong reasons. So you don't have to do this stuff for the right reasons. Nobody does. If you did, don't tell them. But I mean, we're usually motivated by something else. So I finished those amends, you know. And without going into too many details, I'll tell you what ended up happening was I had started dating this guy, and I had told him what I was like. I made it very clear to him what my relationship history was, because this is a program of rigorous honesty. And I let him know that I would like him for a year. By year two, I would despise him. And then that relationship would last for another 4 years and die that slow, painful death. It would be over at year six. That was my deal. If you wanted to be involved with me, you better ask me within year one to marry you, or it's over, you know? So that was one of the first conversations. I don't know how sober this guy was, because he came back for more. And So about a year into this, he asked me to marry him, you know. And he was the most spiritual man I had ever met. The first time I had ever stayed at his house, he got down on his knees in front of me and he prayed to his God, because that's who was number one in his life. And he didn't care what I thought of that. He didn't even consider it, you know. And it was the first spiritual and adult relationship I ever had. And I'm 45 years old at this point, you know. So I marry him. And I've already gotten some of the things back that you may or may not get back working this program, you know. I own a little condo, and we buy a house. And I moved to Pennsylvania, close to Valley Forge, you know. And we get two dogs. And, you know, and it's a pretty cool deal. And I'm working, I'm really working a program, you know. And my sponsor was very, very spiritual. She still is. And she took me to step 10. And she taught me that we live life a certain way. We don't just kind of read step 10. What we do is, when we're feeling, you know, like we're dropping the ball, and you know that feeling, you're a little uncomfortable, you know, you're angry, you're selfish, you're being dishonest, you're not liking it. She's like, you don't even have to think about it. We have training wheels for that. We've got, like, steps you follow. You know, when you feel that, you immediately ask God to take it away. It's that simple. You just ask God to take it away, whatever your God is, you know. And you share that with somebody else. It doesn't have to be somebody in the program. And if you have to make an amends, you know, you've done something, you've said something, you make that amends right away. And you turn your attention to being of service to somebody else, you know. And that's what you do. And you do it on a daily basis until it's automatic. You can't possibly live like that and not see the world differently, you know. And she took me to step 11. And she said step 11 kind of, you know, surrounds step 10. Because we wake up in the morning and we talk to our God, you know, whatever that means. And we ask that our thinking and that our day be directed not by what we want, but what our higher power would want. And again, you know, we're taking 6 and 7 with us. We're trusting, you know. I don't have to worry about what you do or say. You know, I don't have to worry about what happens in the office. I just have to show up and be of service. If you're new and that doesn't sound like much, let me tell you, to not have the screaming in your head every time somebody does something, to not want to fix your husband, fix your wife, fix your kids, to realize that none of that is any of your business, but that all you have to do is trust in this higher power, and whatever your role is supposed to be is going to be presented, there is tremendous power and freedom in that. That allows you to be present to do what you're really supposed to be doing, right? And you have to experience that, you know. I know you've seen glimpses of it. How it worked for me at that point in my life was we did end up selling that business. And I did, now I have to go back to work in the profession that I wasn't capable of being in. And the reason I couldn't be in that profession was because I was an alcoholic, and they had deadlines, they had rules, they had authority, they had all of the things that we are not good at. you know, required to show up, required to sit at a desk, can't do it. So I get a job in New Jersey. It's perfect for me. It's temporary. Somebody had died unexpectedly. They needed somebody immediately until they could fill the position. I applied for it. I get the job. I am not qualified. This is not humility. I am not qualified. It's in my profession. But I do not have the skill set to do it. I've been away from this, and it's specialized for a very long time. So you know what I do? I don't freak out. I don't try to BS them. I don't do what I would do if I was an active alcoholic or even somebody that didn't have a power in their life. I get in the car in the morning for my hour and a half commute. I talk to my sponsor, who switches the dial a little bit, and I say to my higher power, genuinely, I can't do this. You do it. I just can't, you know. So when I show up at the office, the only thing I have to do is honestly do what's in front of me. I don't have to impress the person that gave me the assignment, you know. I don't have to care if you're making fun of me because I'm not smart enough. I don't have to worry about any of those things. All I have to do is show up, trust that I'm there for a reason, and be of service. You know, that's a lot less pressure. It's 8 years later, I'm still there. You know, when it came time for me to leave, they didn't want me to. It's kind of amazing, you know, and I didn't want to leave. You know, because instead of trying to beat the game, what happened was I had great respect for the people I was working with, something I never did, you know. I end up back in New Jersey. But all of this by way of saying, you know, it's kind of the path we take. You know, the steps are not difficult. You know, what I just relayed to you is not difficult. And it takes us to sort of the payoff in all of this, step 12, right? Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And what does that mean? You know, you guys study the book, you know what it means. It means that having done this work, and even though it makes absolutely no sense, you are a different person. You see the world through a different set of glasses. You're not afraid anymore. The cowboys aren't there all the time. You are consciously aware that you can tap into a power, not just your power, the same power everybody else has, and do anything you need to do. There is nothing in front of your path that you don't have the power to do. That's a pretty remarkable place to be. And the most, you know, one of the things we do best is not get jobs, keep jobs, make money. And a lot of that stuff does come. Honestly, it does. But it doesn't matter if it doesn't. Because what ends up happening, which is like the cruelest trick of the program, is that you don't care about that stuff as much. You know, what really ends up happening is you start to realize that, oh my God, we have the power, you know, to be together as a group, to be part of something big, to carry a message to a guy that's going to die, you know, to carry a message to a woman that's suffering, you know, to help her to live a free life. What a gift, you know. That's a big deal, you know. And why the other stuff comes, I don't know, but I think I always think this program is very counterintuitive, you know, like golf, if you golf. Because the harder you swing the club, the crappier the results, you know. The more you try to wrestle things out of your God in this program, the crappier the results. You know, when you sit back and you receive what you already have, all we're really doing here is stopping long enough to go, stop trusting what you're thinking, you know. Stop it. You know, just receive what you have. Go out and do it without fear, with trust. Carry this message, you know. And what ends up happening is that you become that man and woman of dignity and honor, you know, that you always wanted to be. You become that person of great hope because you know there's nothing you can't do. You start to listen to other people's messages and you have that ready when life hits you. I will share something. I don't share that often, but I'm going to because I've got some time, and then I'll wrap it up. There were a lot of good things that happened in my life in sobriety, you know, and there were a lot of difficult things that happened in my life. This is not a year when I showed up particularly well to people in the program, and I just couldn't. And that was okay, because they carried me. Because I'll tell you what happened, and I'll tell you what I learned as an example of this program. My brother, whom I adore, you know, we were thick as thieves. We taught each other how to get student loans so we could get our booze, so we can get our, you know, even when we didn't need them. We were always, you know, helping each other out and how to stay the drunkest, the most messed up, the most irresponsible, how to avoid problems in your life. And he came into the program when he was 18 years old, and he really suffered with this. I understand recidivism very, very well. He went in and out of this program until about almost 4 years ago, about less than 4 years ago, when something happened and he really got it. He became a single father. He got sole custody of his daughter. He started a small business, and he worked with men in recovery. And he still struggled. You know, this was not an easy program when you have to live life. You know, it's a tough program. And so he was moving to a new house last June. And I talked to him every morning, and I talked to him every night, you know. I talked to him that night, you know, around 8 o'clock. He'd moved almost everything out of his house, and his daughter had moved to their new house. He was renting to the new house around the corner. And he had some workers at the house that day, and he had very little left. He was just finishing up. And I said goodnight, and I learned to do something in this program I never did. You know, I told him when I got off the phone, you know, I love you, man. You know, now you would never, ever have said that in my family. Wouldn't have done it. Not cool. But we did. You know, we knew we loved each other, and we did that in our family. And the next morning, I called him like I always do to, like, rag on somebody, my mother probably, not very spiritual. And he doesn't answer the phone. And I find out at 7:30 that he didn't show up to let his crew out because my cousin runs the business. And I know my brother better than I know myself. And he's a fireman, so I leave a message. And I say, I'm going to call the police for a wellness check if you don't call me back. Now, that's going to get an immediate reaction. It's going to be something like, B, U, blankety blank. You know, I'm on a job. Cut me a break. I'll call you later. You're a blankety blank. And I got no response. So I call for the wellness check. And I know he's had a heart attack. I know he's dead. So I don't even bother waiting for them to call back. I get in the car, I go to my brother's house. And when I get there, the street is taped off, you know, and there's a lot of cop cars, and there's not a lot of ambulance activity going on. And there's a dead body in the basement of my brother's house, you know. And my niece is around the corner, oblivious to this, in the new house. And what happened was, one of the guys that had worked at my brother's house, who had been struggling with this program, who had done some time himself, came back that night after getting all messed up on a run down to Newark and beat him to death for $500 and left him on the floor of his basement to die. And if you don't think that that took some program, it took some program. And I did remember something, and I'll share it with you. A year before, I had been at a retreat, and Sandy Beach, who I know many of you have heard, whom I absolutely love, was talking about the death of his daughter. And he said, when those things happen, when tragedy happens, when you get that diagnosis, you have a moment, you know. And in that moment, what you need to do is you need to say to your God, no matter what happens, no matter what this news is, I'm not going to feel any differently about you, you know, so that when that news finally hits, no matter what it is, you can deal with the grief, or you can deal with the diagnosis, or you can deal with whatever the news is, because you got your higher power, you know, to get you through that. Because the thing that's going to kill us is the anger and the resentment and all of the personality defects that we asked our God to remove, you know. So I didn't have to walk through that alone, you know. You guys told me exactly what to do, leaving no room for interpretation, you know. So at 45, I'm a wife and a dog owner, and at 52, I'm a mother. So it's amazing what happens in this program. My niece came to live with me, a huge blessing. And my brother's still with me, because I stand, if not for him, I might not be in this program, you know. So he carried this message as well. When I tell you there is nothing you can't do, there is nothing you can't walk through, there is nothing you can't achieve, I'm speaking from experience. If you are unhappy in where you are, if you're feeling you haven't hit the mark, it's because you haven't. So get out of the way. Trust the higher power that's already with you. Go out there. Do this deal. Carry this message. Be the man and the woman you were born to be, you know. This place brings me great hope. It is a powerhouse. Grab onto it if you're new. Grab onto it again if you're not. Thank you for letting me share.